You want kicking things out of orbit?
Oh my gosh!
How many minutes is Nokia Silver?
One of the greatest fighters.
John Jones beat every champion. Pretty much now.
Khabib gets his hands on McGregor, it's gonna be that night.
Let's get into it.
Hello! You are listening to the Fight Night Picks Recap Show. I'm John Franklin. This week on the show, we discuss all the fights from UFC Fight Night. Rozenstruik vs. Gon, a.k.a. UFC Vegas 20. I will do all this in one half of the Fight Night Picks preview show. I'm speaking, of course, to the great Matt Allen. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing great. You say all those great fights, all nine of them. They were fights and they happened. And that's going to be the best breakdown I think I can give this whole evening.
That's the long and the short of it. All right, Matt, Saturday night in the Apex was not jumping, but the fights were live and some interesting subplots came out of the action. So let's get into it. We'll start at the top in the heavyweight division. I have said on every show that I am on and to everyone that will listen to me on this network that the future of the UFC might very well be in the heavyweight division. So let's talk about what we had on this night, which was Ciryl Gane and Jairzinho Rozenstruik coming into Saturday night. Both Ciryl Gane and Jairzinho Rozenstruik had one thing in common. They're both coming off a second-round stoppage wins over former heavyweight champion of the world, Junior Dos Santos. Gane was undefeated, and Rozenstruik only had one blemish on his record, that coming at the right hand of number one contender Francis Ngannou. So, Matt, we thought after the week we got a heavyweight, this was going to be the cherry on the sundae, and it wasn't. The result read Ciryl Gane defeating Jairzinho Rozenstruik, the unanimous decision. 50-45s all over the place. It had big Derek Lewis, Francis Ngannou vibes. What'd you see in this one, Matt?
Listen, that's not the most entertaining heavyweight main event you're ever going to get. And here's the thing. We were kind of spoiled with heavyweight main events recently. You go back, think Overeem Volkov. Well, that was an amazing fight that ended in a spectacular finish. Then you go back to the last heavyweight main event. Derek Lewis, Curtis Blaydes, another fantastic fight that ended in a spectacular finish. So we kind of have this great taste left in our mouth after those two fights. You're like, okay, well, of course, this is going to be a great fight. You have two extremely technical strikers. And I know Ciryl Gane can take the fight to the ground, but definitely the narrative going into this fight was, oh, how good of a striker he was, how complete of a fighter he is, and just really how good he is at distance. And we saw that in this fight, and that was the weird thing about this fight. Ciryl Gane proved that he was the better fighter, don't get me wrong, but what he really proved in this fight was he's amazing at distance management. And again, it's not something a lot of heavyweights really do have, and it's kind of interesting moving forward because there's not a lot of guys in the division who can keep up with the mobility of Ciryl Gane. And I know it was the most impressive performance, and I know we'll probably get it, well, I guess that's what this is about. We're talking about how, you know, unimpressive it was, but still, he put on enough of a show that tells me, okay, I don't really know who can beat Ciryl Gane with his style, but he didn't leave such an imprint that, you know, I know Craig hates this term, but I'm going to have to use it. We're the casual audience who may have never seen Ciryl Gane fight before. They're not coming back for seconds. It's not a fighter who they're going to have to see fight again. And it is unfortunate because Craig's probably the conductor of the Ciryl Gane hype train, I'd say right now. And he's waiting for people to jump on board. And after a performance like that, you would think beating a guy by unanimous decision, winning every single round of a fight, we'd all be really impressed the next day. But I got to be honest, Ciryl Gane, I feel the same way about him now as I did before the fight. He won the fight. It's an extra win on his resume, but I don't really feel any differently towards him.
So we'll get to the takeaways. I thought Paul Felder made some good points after the fight in terms of what we take away with Ciryl Gane. Let's talk, you know, it's a beat to death cliche in MMA recaps, the autopsy, right? But I want to use it as an analogy here because, you know, when you have a bad fight, there's a lot of blame to go around. But who do you think really has the blood on their hands on this one? Who do you think is the reason why this fight wasn't the greatest?
I mean, Jairzinho would have blood on his hands if he threw them at some point during this fight. And that was the problem. Here's the thing with Rozenstruik, too, and I should have known this going back. He's not good at moving forward. It's weird. Most fighters are great moving forward, then they have to learn how to fight backwards. Jairzinho constantly waits for the counter, and he always wants that check left hook because he knows how powerful it is, and he can draw people into his power when they're being very aggressive. When he's dealing with someone who has great movement on the outside, he's so tentative to really pull the trigger and exert himself and really push just the pressure because he's waiting for the counter to kind of be returned his way. So for Rozenstruik, I understand just kind of the way he fights at this point. And when he does get in there with a guy who moves forward, we kind of see what happens. Like Andre Arlovsky, I know he was old when he fought Rozenstruik, but he took one step forward, got cracked, and was never really the same after that. And I guess it's hard to never be the same when you're 45 and you've had 75 knockout losses. But still, Rozenstruik has moments in his UFC career where you look at him and you're like, wow, this guy is as powerful as Francis, and he has some of the technique of Overeem. And if he can really put it together, we've got a special contender here. And then you watch his fights, and yes, some of them have ended in spectacular fashions, but look at the Albini fight. He loses every minute of the fight till he lands the combo at the starting of the second round. You look at the Overeem fight, and that one's, of course, the most popular example. He loses every second of that fight, pretty much, and then knocks Overeem out at the end of it. I don't want to say he's the ultimate kind of get lucky fighter, because we sort of said that about Derek Lewis, but for Jairzinho, it's I'm going to lose a fight until I win it. It's not I'm winning a fight until I'm losing it, if that makes any sense. He's sort of the opposite of GSP, where GSP was always in control no matter what happened, unless you could hit him with a head kick, unless you could hit him with an overhand right that would get him off of his game plan. With Jairzinho, his game plan is to wait for you to make a mistake. And if you are one of these guys like a Ciryl Gane, if you are, even think of a Volkov who can stand at such a range that he's going to be outside of a lot of your counter strikes. Rozenstruik's going to struggle with all those top tier strikers, especially in the heavyweight division.
Well, and we used this analogy before, you know, Rozenstruik is a, he's an octagon procrastinator, right? He waits till the last minute to do the project. And because he pulls it off and gets the A, he thinks that it's okay, right? He thinks, okay, I'm a guy that does well in crunch time. That's what people will tell you, right? I do well when it's when you know when the chips are online, you know, when the stakes are high. Except when you run into somebody that doesn't fall into those traps. So I promise you, Matt, because I think this is really a worn out labeling. I'll say it because I don't want to be you know one of those guys that talks in vagueness, but. You know, this whole thing of calling somebody a problem, I won't do that because I'm done with it. But do you think that Ciryl Gane is a bad matchup in the heavyweight division or just a bad matchup for Jairzinho Rozenstruik?
It's a little bit of both. And it's hard to say that. I know it is a cop-out. I sound a lot like Brendan Schaub. But Jairzinho is just kind of an example of what a lot of heavyweights are at this point. Extremely heavy-handed, who kind of wait on the counter. And if you are active enough, you can beat a lot of heavyweights. Let's just be honest. I think the reason Jon Jones has success, or will have success, I guess, at heavyweight, isn't because he's at the peak of his career or that he's better than a lot of these heavyweight fighters. He fights like a 205-pound fighter, and heavyweights have always sort of just had this style where if you are sort of light on your feet and you can get in and out and just evade their counters, you can outstrike a lot of them. And Tanner Bowser, to a lesser degree, I know that's one of Craig's favorite unranked fighters really of all time, but Tanner Bowser is a good example of this. I know he lost to Arlovsky, but you look at him at heavyweight, he's just kind of out-voluming guys because he is more athletic. And if you look at Ciryl Gane, I think he can do this to someone like Rozenstruik, who really has to plant his feet to get big power shots off at you. But then think about Stipe. Stipe can punch you moving forward, moving backwards, is extremely defensive, is very defensively sound, and is impossible to take down. Do you really think Ciryl Gane's going to be able to kind of jump in and out with that sort of knockoff Lyoto Machida style against someone like Stipe? Not at all. I think he will have success against guys who have to plant their feet and throw, like the Rozenstruiks. Honestly, even against the Francises of the world, because if Ciryl can go out there, chop at his leg, and not get involved in one of those big firefights, he will have success against some of the sloppier guys. But when you do look at the division, I think he'd have trouble with the wrestling of Curtis Blaydes. I know a lot of people are down on Curtis Blaydes, but I think that's sort of one of those skill checks he's going to have to pass on his way up. I think Stipe gives him a lot of trouble. And I know, of course, the greatest heavyweight of all time is going to give a guy with 8 professional fights trouble. But still, those are the people who we're going to be expecting Ciryl Gane to be matched up with next. And it will be interesting because right now, I think he is going to be matched up with Volkov. I think that's the most obvious fight moving forward. We know that Jon Jones is going to fight the winner of Francis and Stipe. Derek Lewis is out there. That could be a fun fight. But personally, I just see them going Ciryl and Volkov. I think that's a really fun fight. But even Volkov, he's extremely mobile, one of the bigger heavyweights you can be, and not just size wise frame wise as well. He is massive in that cage, and you look at him weighing in at 265. When that Russian comes in thick, he hits super hard. And Ciryl, here's the thing, and this is my big point coming into this fight, I've never seen him overcome adversity. And I know you're a Teddy Atlas fan, so you know what I'm about to say. A fight's not a fight until you overcome something. And there's a reason Dustin Poirier is my favorite fighter of all time. All of his fights, he gets cracked, goes through this crazy war, and then he still ends up coming out on top. For Ciryl Gane, I've seen a lot of beautiful technique. I've seen a lot of very high skill moments in the cage. I've never seen him overcome adversity. So personally, I think he has all the skills. I think he is going to be in the top 5 at a minimum for a very long time. I still need to see him get cracked once clean and kind of overcome that before I'm really sold on Ciryl Gane moving forward.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what gets interesting with these guys, you know, because you do see a lot of, I don't say a lot, you see a little of Jon Jones in Ciryl Gane in terms of some of the hand fighting, teep kicks, his movement. So there's something there, meaning that if you can get to number 5 just off talent before you face any adversity, I'm with you. I don't like matching him up with somebody like Lewis because he really could run the Rozenstruik playbook out against Lewis. So we talk about these championship checklists, right? What does it take to be a champion? I like what Paul Felder said after the fight. He said, listen, he's 8-0. He's had his first 5-round fight, and he won all the rounds. So is it the most impressive thing I've ever seen? No, but had he knocked Rozenstruik out in the first round, we'd still have questions about him going long in a fight and all these different things. Now, he wasn't pushed by Jairzinho, but he did what he had to do. He saw what was presented to him, and he found a path to victory. He was never in any real danger. He stayed out of the way of, you know, although I don't think that Rozenstruik was on his game last night. You know, there were some opportunities to catch Gon, and Gon was kind of there and you know, to throw a shitty pun at you, he was gone. So I think that, you know, next up for him, and we're going to get to the who's calling part of it, which I love in these things, but I want to talk real quick about the John Jones tweet and the Francis Ngannou tweet. Jones tweeted, these boys better get used to pushing the pace. All this standing around ain't going to fly when daddy comes home. Do you think John Jones can push the pace at heavyweight?
When was the last time John Jones pushed the pace at 205, and he's the greatest light heavyweight of all time? I like John Jones as a skill set, and there's not a lot of fighters I kind of have to say that about, but TJ Dillashaw and John Jones are kind of the only two fighters this applies to. I love watching TJ Dillashaw. There's not many things in MMA I enjoy more than watching TJ. He's got amazing striking. He's this phenomenal wrestler. There's nothing he does that isn't aesthetically pleasing in the cage, and John Jones is sort of cut from that same cloth before PEDs got banned. And then USADA came into the mix, and he had that fight with Gustafson, switched across border lines or state lines, and you can be your own conspiracy theorist with that. The John Jones that we've seen in the Anthony Smith fight, the Thiago Santos fight, and the Dominic Reyes fight is not the same John Jones. If we had seen him, let's say we saw the same Anthony Smith fight that we saw. He goes out there, and he looks good, but it's very much a tune-up fight for him. Then he comes back, and he absolutely dominates Thiago Santos on one leg, basically, in that fight. Takes him down, ground and pounds him. And then he does the same thing to Dominic Reyes. I'd be sitting here telling you, oh, he's going to destroy Stipe at heavyweight. That's not the fighter that we're getting anymore. He's very happy to sit on the outside. And the comparison with Gon is a good one, because he will kind of play that. And I'm going to use the term pitter-patter, but I don't mean to take away from, I'm sure, the impact that Gon and John Jones both land with. But he can kind of play that, I'll say, soft volume game, because it's not like a Max Holloway. Where Max Holloway, and I'm going to quote Dwayne Casey and, oddly enough, Doris Burke from 2K12, the NBA game. But Dwayne Casey once put a big boulder in the Raptors' locker room, and he said, listen, guys, if you hit it one time, it's not going to break. But if you pound that rock 1,000 times, eventually it's going to break. And again, basketball and MMA are very different sports, but the mindset is still the same. And for John Jones, I think he can fight at heavyweight in the way that we saw him fight at 205. But again, you can't be tweeting out if we've only seen the worst version of you in the last 3 years. We haven't seen a good version of John Jones fight a high level of competition, I'd argue, since DC at UFC 214. And that was, what, 3 years ago, 4 years ago now? Like, it's been a while since we've really seen the top tier of John Jones. And I'm going to bring up Chris Cyborg for this, too, because I think it's an important point. I can always, one of my cockier picks was I said Amanda Nunes is going to stop Chris Cyborg. And the reason I said that was because when you're Chris Cyborg and you're fighting a diminished level of competition your whole career and you're just blowing the doors off them, you don't really know how good you are. And John Jones, in his last little run, if you want to talk about not facing any adversity, yeah, Dominic Reyes won rounds, but other than sort of landing against John Jones, it's not like he took him down. It's not like he really had him in danger. John Jones might have to fight Stipe Miocic next. He's going to put you in danger. And one of the few things John Jones isn't great at in the cage is boxing. He's not a great pure boxer when it comes to MMA. Do you know who's insane at boxing? Stipe Miocic. This firefighter from Cleveland has absurd cardio, never stops punching, and has crippling power. So if you're John Jones, stop tweeting and start fighting at heavyweight. You can't say, oh, daddy's on his way or whatever, until you actually show what you're tweeting about. I haven't seen him push the pace, so I'm not that concerned about John Jones at heavyweight. I'm more excited about Francis's tweet than anything.
Yeah, I agree. So, okay, my only pushback to that, because I'm convinced that one night, I think it was the night that Rampage fought Rashad, I got pretty drunk in Vegas, and I think that I was running around Vegas with a pre-fame John Jones telling him he should have been in the fight. So either one of two things happened. Either this really happened and it was John Jones, because I think he was with his brother, or it was a guy who I thought was John Jones who was just like, I'm going to just walk around with this drunk white kid all night and, you know, just humor him. But anyway, I'm going to defend John Jones in this way. You could make
that story's a whole segment. Story. That story's a whole segment. That's not just like, oh, I'm going to drop this on the recap show for 5 seconds, John Franklin.
We'll get there. We'll get there. You're right.
Animate it short.
Yes, it is. It's a fight lore story. Here's the thing. USADA, I understand the USADA argument. I don't disagree with it. The other argument could be maybe he, much like George St. Pierre, realized, okay, these guys at 205 are catching up. And they're faster than they used to be. I used to be the fastest guy in this division, and now I'm not. Now it's time to go to heavyweight. So I guess my question for you, and we'll move on. Guys, trust me. If you think that because the first fight we're going long, that the whole recap show is going to be long, you're sadly mistaken.
It was a short falls off fight, quick.
and they weren't great. So anyway, do you think that Jones, I think he's middle of the pack speed-wise at 205, but he could be one of the faster heavyweights. Now, is he fast enough to stay out of the way of Stipe's punches? I don't know. Is he fast enough to stay out of the way of Francis's punches? That remains to be seen. But I'm talking about he could be one of the faster heavyweights, right?
I agree. But
that's
again,
where it gets interesting.
The only fight, though, that he's involved in next is either against Francis and Stipe. And those are really the only guys, so I care about him fighting at heavyweight. Because here's the thing. I don't really want to see John Jones fight Derek Lewis. Like, spoiler alert, that fight doesn't do anything for me. The fights that do a lot for me, though, is you have two of the greatest fighters we've ever seen. Stipe Miocic, the heavyweight GOAT. No argument at all. I think it's pretty much everyone can agree. Stipe Miocic is the best heavyweight of all time. Maybe if you want to throw Fedor in there, but it's one of those two. John Jones is hands down the greatest 205 fighter of all time. This is like DC Stipe. But almost like a heightened expectation just because John is the only guy who had beat Stipe before. I understand the expectations are going to be there and the hype's going to be there for that fight. I think Stipe destroys John Jones, and that might be one of my hotter takes of all time. I don't think that fight's overly
competitive.
I'd say so. Yeah, and I'm sorry. I just don't like, I think Stipe should be a favorite in that fight because it's my get out of jail free theory. If you're a fighter and you get into adversity, you always have your get out of jail free card. And the most recent example I can bring up is look at Overeem against Volkov. Every time Overeem's ever been in trouble in his career, what does he do? You talked about the tie clinch, I guess, before we started recording. He clinches guys up because he knows immediately I can elbow them, I can knee them, and no one can hang with me in the clinch. Then he fought Volkov, who A, just physically, you can't really clinch him because he is so big. And B, that's where he's really good at too. He didn't have his get out of jail free card in that fight. John Jones' get out of jail free card is his wrestling. He can throw the volume on the feet. He can throw so many unorthodox techniques, but where he really gets it done is he takes people down and he ground and pounds them. That's the best version of John Jones. I'm telling you right now, John Jones does not take down Stipe Miocic. I will make some crazy bet with Craig when that fight, or if that fight ever does come up, but I'm way too confident that Stipe beats John. The more exciting fight's Francis, because that's all power versus all technique.
It sounds like a tattoo bet, but that's for another day. So here's where it gets interesting though, because listen, all these guys who think John Jones coming to heavyweight is their ticket to fighting John Jones, Ciryl Gane, Rozenstruik, Lewis, you know, some of these other guys. Here's the news, guys. This is the John Jones retirement plan, just so you know. It's Stipe and or Francis, then the other one, then Izzy. Because if he wins all three of those fights, if he beats Francis and Stipe and Izzy, then he gets to pick what division he wants to fight in. He's such a massive star. He's so clearly the GOAT that now he's carrying either division. So if you want him to fight Blachowicz or Reyes or whoever the flavor of the month is at 205, he's such a huge star after winning those three fights that he can do it. If you want him to stay up and fight Gane or at whoever you want at heavyweight, he's such a massive star that he can carry either division. That so he could demand an insane amount of money from the UFC or walk away, because that's the retirement plan. It's those three fights. So if you're waiting for John Jones to win this heavyweight belt and just defend it like he defended light heavyweight, you're nuts. It's these two and Izzy. If Izzy
then
wins,
he box like Alexei Oleinik or no, Usyk or whoever.
Usyk, yeah, something yeah, like
that. He could have some fun after that.
He certainly could. All right, let's move on to the co-main event. Oh, real quick. Who's calling? Who's calling Ciryl Gane? The coach, the matchmaker, or Dana?
I think Dana probably called his coach to talk to him. You know, like Dana wouldn't reach out directly because that's a big deal when Dana White like either follows you on Instagram or sends you a DM and says good job. Like, you know, the fighters really appreciate that. And this
wasn't
like
that good of a performance.
No, not at all. And okay, here's a great example. When Pedro Munhoz was leaving the cage, he won a spectacular back and forth fight. It was phenomenal. It was fight of the night for a reason. Dana White got up and like congratulated him as he was walking out of the arena, like in that little hallway there. He was like, man, amazing fight. Like, great job. He was singing his praises. I didn't see any of that for Ciryl Gane. And I'd be surprised. I don't know how many Instagram followers Ciryl Gane has. I doubt Dana White's one of them today. So Dana White probably got a hold of someone involved in Ciryl Gane's camp to be like, hey, it was an impressive win, but now you have to fight like Marcin Tybura on a prelim fight night, like main event. You know, like they're not doing any favors for Ciryl Gane next, although it was a win.
Right. Well, they're talking about what's next, but it's not a big thing. Rozenstruik gets the coach, right?
Oh, yeah. Fire him? Like, no. Okay. Because here's the thing. Rozenstruik trains an American top team. I'm almost certain of. And it's weird because most heavyweights at ATT have a lot of success. Arlovski went there. He changed up his style and he started to have more success. JDS went there. He started to do well. Rozenstruik, again, he's in that weird category because I think he can knock out any heavyweight in the world. I really do. But I think pretty much any heavyweight in the world can probably 50-45 him. And I don't want to say he's the new Mark Hunt, but he does feel that way to me. He's either going to win by knockout or lose the decision looking for that knockout. I don't really see it any other way.
Yeah, I agree. All right, let's move on to the co-main event. Matt, for all the juice in the heavyweight division, light heavyweight has seen better days. Don't cry for 205, though, because in a week's time, they may be crowning the sport's most electric fighter, Israel Adesanya, their champion. But there is certainly a lack of depth, which meant Saturday night was a huge opportunity for Magomed Ankalaev and Nikita Krylov to get their names on the tip of both the fans and the UFC brass's tongues. And I don't think they delivered on that. The result reads Ankalaev defeating Krylov via unanimous decision. 29-28, it's all over. I must admit, I did feel better when I reflected on this fight than when I was watching it. But it wasn't exactly a barn burner by any definition of that phrase. That's what I saw. What'd you see?
It was just a really average fight. And it's the best way to say it. Like, there was little grappling, little striking. Nothing really stood out. It was odd because Ankalaev, he's got that one weird loss to Paul Craig, of course, that Hail Mary submission with 1 second left. That's the only blemish in his record. And other than that, it's really the only blemish in his career. Like, he is this phenomenal power punching, extremely accurate striker with great takedown defense. And a lot of the times in the UFC, if you have phenomenal takedown defense and striking to match, you're probably going to go really far. And I thought this stylistic matchup was a perfect one to at least give Ankalaev another highlight for his reel. Not that Nikita Krylov is a bad fighter by any means, but he's a fighter who will always fight the level of his competition, whether he's fighting John Jones or whether he's fighting John Franklin. Like, there's no real difference between the two in his mind. And it's weird because until his last three fights, he had never gone to decision before in his career. Win or loss, he'd either won or lost every single fight by submission or knockout. So A, definitely changed that, which I guess he has, which is a good sign. I just don't know what Krylov could have done different, because this is the weird thing, and I brought this up to Craig. He kept on landing that weird, like, jump knee straight right. It could not miss, but there was nothing behind it. Like, it wasn't really bothering Ankalaev. It was just this weird technique that Krylov kept on throwing out over and over, and it wouldn't miss, and Ankalaev was doing the right thing. He kept on throwing a check right hook, and it kept on landing. It's just he would never really sit down on one and put a lot of pressure behind it. And of course, I'm going to bring him up, my favorite fighter. Look at when Poirier fought McGregor. When he throws that right hook before he kind of spins around towards the cage, like, there's some force behind that. He plants his feet and throws that punch. For Ankalaev, he was always kind of moving backwards and he was hitting him with those check hooks. So it was just a frustrating performance because I felt like Ankalaev could have done more. He was landing the shots. The accuracy was there. It's just from a big power puncher like Ankalaev, you expect a guy to fall down after he does eat so many shots from him. But Krylov did a decent enough job staying in the fight. Again, this is another one of those fights. Did you learn anything about either one of these guys? Because I certainly didn't. I think Krylov can beat most unranked light heavyweights and probably lose to a lot of ranked ones. And I think Ankalaev is going to be a 5 to 10 guy on his best day and a 10 to 15 guy on his worst. I think he's going to be in the rankings at 205. But I think that's more a conversation just about where the division is as a total right now. It's unfortunate, but I had high hopes going into this fight. And I left with not a sour taste in my mouth, because it's not like it was the worst fight I've ever seen, but I really thought Ankalaev one day could be at the top of the division, could give guys like the Jan Blachowiczs and the Dominic Reyeses of the world a tough time. It's wild that at light heavyweight, that's who I'm talking about. Like, at lightweight, we'd be talking about, oh, wow, can Thiago Moises take on the Tony Fergusons and Charles Oliveira? No, you have to beat, like, the Anthony Smiths of the world at 205, and there's nothing against that. Anthony Smith's still a great fighter, but I think Ankalaev could probably beat him. I just don't see him beating the Jan Blachowiczs or the really elite at 205. So I think we just got a decent fight between two decent 205ers.
Here's the worst thing I could say, guys, about a co-main event. And I'm sorry I'm saying it about your fight if you guys happen to be listening to the show. But if you ask me in a week who won this fight, I say Ankalaev. If you ask me in 2 weeks, I struggle, but probably still say Ankalaev. If you ask me in a month, I have no idea. Which means this fight was pretty even and pretty forgettable. So I think that for these guys, they didn't accomplish anything. They didn't leave a mark on the fan base. They didn't leave a mark on the UFC brass, and nobody really cared. And for a co-main event spot, that's not a good – I mean, it's better to, you know, go out there, get after it, and maybe make some things happen. And not that these guys weren't pushing the action at times, but I think they were both kind of sort of predisposed in their mind to this is how I want it to go, and no one seemed to be overextending themselves. And sometimes when you want to make those leaps in the rankings and really change your career around, you got to extend yourself a little bit. I didn't see a lot of that.
Is the co-main and main event from this weekend the best example of for why excitement boosts you up in the rankings? Like, excitement to UFC fans is like rocket fuel on your back through the rankings. That's all the UFC cares about. And when they want to make stars, yeah, it's good if you're handsome and you can speak well. They only care if you're exciting in the cage. And I really do think that's the big thing, because Pedro Munhoz, Jimmy Rivera, I understand those are higher ranked fighters. They might have more, I'd say, widespread fan appeal, but it's not like Pedro Munhoz and Jimmy Rivera are blowing the doors off any places. But everyone on Twitter was talking about that fight, and no one cared about the co-main or main event. I really do think that it's just, it's interesting when you do think, okay, main event is supposed to be the most prestigious spot on the card, but let's be honest, the fight of the night tends to be the one that we're talking about the next day and the day after.
You know, and the one thing we didn't talk about, which we should have with the main event, was that maybe those boys were fighting, maybe not gone, because he did seem like he was getting after it, didn't have a willing dance partner. But it seemed like the tone of that fight was, I just watched all this great heavyweight action, I don't want to lose any ground in this division. I just want to get this win.
I think that's a great point.
You know what I mean? I that's the vibe I got from it. All right. Who's calling? The coach, the matchmaker, or Dana? Dana's not calling either of these guys.
No, is it the coach? Dana couldn't even spell Ankalaev. Yeah, the coach probably. Listen, Frank Alive, I still think he does have a high ceiling. I got to be honest. I was a bit of a Debbie Downer from what we just talked about, but I still think he has a high ceiling. And it's more, again, 205 is not the best division right now. Volkan Oezdemir and Anthony Smith are considered elite. And I like both of those guys, but you look at their skill sets, and I wouldn't say that their skill sets are elite. I would just say their placement in the division is elite. And right now, Frank Alive, I think he could get in, maybe fight an Oezdemir next, maybe fight a Smith next. I doubt he gets that much further up in the rankings. I don't see him fighting, you know, a Reyes or a Prochazka. I do think he needs maybe one or two more wins till he gets up into the top five. But for, yeah, Ankalaev, I guess Anthony Smith's fighting Jimmy Crute next. So, yeah, Volkan Oezdemir is probably the bet.
All right, let's move on. Matt, coming into Saturday, there was a couple of flyweights who were just outside the top 15 of the UFC. However, Macy Barber is ranked 15th. We just talked about this. It's perfect that you led me into this. So Barber losing, the door was slightly ajar if the right performance was put on to maybe crack that top 15. And this was not the performance, I feel, that either lady put on to get into that top 15. They both sort of had their moments. And listen, MDLR left with one hell of a hematoma for the ages on that left eye. But neither fighter, I thought, was overly impressive. I'm going to throw something at you here. And this fight, to me, had Haas Imavov vibes, with MDLR controlling the in-close space. And every time Buena Silva got some space, she was cracking her. What'd you see in this fight? Were you impressed? Am I too down on this fight?
No, I like the fact that you brought up the damage about Montana De La Rosa, because that's actually like one of the only notes that I took as I was watching the fights last night. She takes damage like awful in fights, and I don't know what it is. Even go back and look at like the Andrea Lee fight. Just something about Montana De La Rosa. It's not even that she bruises like a peach. Like, if she gets touched, it turns into a bad injury. And again, it's unfortunate, because I do think Mara Buena Silva is a good striker. I don't think she's a I'm going to swell both of your eyes shut kind of striker. I think she landed good strikes in that fight, but it is just something to look out for moving forward. Montana De La Rosa does not wear damage well at all in her fights. This was a great example of I'm a better wrestler, but you're the more well-rounded fighter. Listen, I thought Mara Buena Silva won two of the three rounds, and Craig even thought she won all three rounds and gave her the fight even with the point deduction. Now, I'm not crazy like the other half of the Allen Bros, but I thought it was one of the... I thought Mara Buena Silva won two rounds. I thought De La Rosa won the one with the point deduction. It's a draw. Not an impressive fight. And again, people get on me, especially on Twitter, for saying this, but it's the truth. When I look at this division, especially women's flyweight, you only need one or two wins to get up in the rankings. Like, was Macy Barber ever really supposed to be in the top 10? No, but she was at one point, because she talked a lot. She had decent TKO wins, which, you know, do matter. She's stopping fights. And she just kept on saying, I'm going to fight Valentina. I'm going to fight Valentina. In that division, all you need to say is, hey, I want to fight for the title. And they're probably going to give you the chance. And it's unfortunate.
Don't tell son in line. Just raise your hand.
Exactly. Just raise your hand. That's all you got to do. And right now, listen, I love the fact that they finally matched up Jessica Andrade and Valentina Shevchenko. I love Andrade. I think she's the only woman in that division who even has a remote chance of beating Valentina, if I'm being honest. Do you think Montana De La Rosa could beat Jessica Andrade? No. You would call the cops what you'd see on TV. It would be a terrible massacre. She's not even champ right now, and she's a 3-1 underdog against the champ Valentina. Like, number one and number two are so far ahead in this division that I honestly do have a hard time really getting excited for prospects, because I see Valentina beating everyone and it's not even close. And I see Andrade being kind of that Junior Dos Santos where she could beat everyone in the division. She just can't get over the Cain Velasquez or Valentina hump in this case. So for, again, not impressive for either one. It'll be interesting moving forward because I do think Buena Silva has a ceiling in this division. I think she can get into that top 10 at some point. But with the cage grabs, and you got to be able to create space at one point. Same thing with Imovov when you brought up the Phil Hawes fight. If you're doing well in distance, create distance. I know it's easier said than done, but once you figure out that, okay, I'm having success every time we break the clinch, I'm busting up my opponent, why would you not dedicate every ounce of energy you have to breaking the clinch, digging for that underhook, trying to create separation? And we know De La Rosa, she always comes with that pressure, but I just expected a little bit more out of Buena Silva. I expected her to win. I had her winning two of the three rounds, but I don't know, just the top three fights on this card, normally those are the ones that really deliver, but on this one, they were three of the more poor fights.
Well, and listen, I'm going to quote someone else. Marcellus Wiley has always said, and I'm going to kind of take this quote and put it in another context, but Marcellus Wiley said the best ability is availability. So don't tell me you're a great striker if you can't create space. Don't tell me you're a great shooter if you can't create space. In the NBA, if what you're good at is not available to you, then it doesn't matter. And I think that, like you said, you know, yeah, it's easier said than done. A lot of things are easier said than done. But if that's your bread and butter, then you had the thing that you got to give guys like, and this, it was 100 years ago when they fought, but a guy like Chuck Liddell, he was a good enough wrestler to stay on his feet. You know, I mean, that's all he had to be, was a good enough wrestler to stay on his feet. And he figured out how to buy himself space and find angles. And, you know, he, looking at him now, by comparison of some of these guys that we've seen since him, like, you know, Cruz and Dillashaw and Sandhagen and some of these guys that are really, really slick on their feet, he looks like a dinosaur, which he is, but it was effective. And he defended that title a lot, and those guys haven't, or maybe never will, with the exception of Cruz. So, I mean, that's my point, is that you gotta make your best skills available to you, or what's the point of having them? All right, let's move on to what was the fight of the night. Spoiler alert, Matt, coming into Saturday, the young Punisher, Pedro Munhoz, was on a skid. Side note, at what age are you too old for age-based nicknames? When are you no longer the prodigy? When are you no longer the phenom? Or the
You're losing bar fights in Hawaii because the UFC won't give you fights anymore. That's when you're no longer the prodigy.
That's fair. Anyway, two high-profile losses for Munhoz against Sterling and Edgar have him looking for some answers, and those answers came in the form of Jimmy Rivera's calf. Munhoz found it early and often in route to unanimous victory. Now, Matt, Rivera is a dyed-in-the-wool MMA boxer, and that has served him well in his career. He's gotten in some firefights. He's climbed the ranks. He's been up near the belt a couple of times. But on this night, and always, I mean, he sits down on those punches and swings for the cheap seats. That strategy does not help you when someone is annihilating your calf. So I guess my question is this. Is this just an adjustment that Jimmy Rivera should have made? Or are these goddamn calf kicks taking over the sport?
I think it's a little bit of both. And it's weird because I think if you've used it against an opponent, you should never be susceptible to it yourself. Jimmy Rivera used calf kicks way in the early days of calf kicks. UFC 203, he beat Uriah Faber by unanimous decision by beating the absolute shit out of his leg. And it was not a competitive fight because Jimmy Rivera went out there and he out Uriah Faber. So Jimmy Rivera has good leg kicks. He has good boxing. He's used it to an opponent in the past. That means he must know how effective it is. And if you've used a calf kick and a similar leg kick yourself, how do you not know how to defend it? I know it's weird, and we do see this with some fighters. Go back to Edson Barboza, Justin Gaethje, and I understand you're talking about two of the best leg kickers really ever. Those guys offensively were able to kick each other's legs without any issue. Neither guy checked a single kick that whole entire fight. They were just so offensively minded with it. So I do get it to a certain degree, but if you're Jimmy Rivera, I've seen you use this technique, and I say use it before it was cool. Like, Jimmy Rivera was a fan of Golden State back when they were beating Dallas in the first round, way before they ever had Steph Curry. That's the kind of man Jimmy Rivera is. But now all of a sudden Golden State's bad, and he's like, no, I'm not a fan anymore. That's what Jimmy Rivera reminds me of, because I've seen him use it in the past. And here's the thing with Rivera. He's so frustrating, because you're right. He's a great example of an MMA boxer. He's a pretty darn good wrestler, too, and he can get most guys to the mat. And with Rivera, for him, I never see it as you need to take your opponent down to try to control them. It's not the point at all. You need to take your opponent down to keep them guessing. You need to take your opponent down to make them think, okay, you're not just here being the boxer. And not like Pedro Munhoz, the guy you want to be taking down constantly, but that's my whole point to begin with. You don't want to take them down and control them. You want to take them down just to give them another wrinkle to look at. And he wasn't able to do that. And the 1 second he did take Munhoz down, Munhoz was on an ankle in half a second. Like, Munhoz is just such a dangerous fighter at every range, and that's what I really like about him. And yes, he does spam the leg kicks quite a bit. Like, you fight a lot of guys like him in UFC on or UFC 4 online. It's not very fun, but he's effective everywhere. It's like, when he does throw the hands, he has good boxing. He has a great chin. He's got good cardio. He has a good output. Like, the foundation is there for a phenomenal MMA fighter. I just think with Munhoz, and it's hard to say this because he has been so good for so long, he's another one of these guys who, you look at his striking, it's great. You look at his grappling, it's even better. He just has to put it all together. And he's so close, too. You can just tell that he goes from kind of jiu-jitsu mode into striking mode. And there isn't that wrestling there for him. And I get it. Not a lot of guys do have the wrestling. But I think Munhoz has all the tools to be a world champion. I just don't think he ever will be one. And it kind of sucks to say that. But that's what I look at him as in this division. I think if he fights Pedro, or if he fights Cody Garbrandt again, he probably beats him again. And I think if he fights a lot of guys in the top of the division, he beats them. But the guys like Sterling, who can overwhelm him with his volume, the guys like Jan, who can just outbox you, they're always going to give him troubles. And for that reason, I just don't think Pedro Munhoz will ever be considered the elite of the elite. I look at it as him as, he's kind of like Bantamweight's Derek Brunson. He's the gatekeeper to the elite. Like, if you beat Pedro Munhoz, it's off. You're only fighting like the top guys in the division from now on. And if you lose to Pedro Munhoz, it's not really the end of the world. Like, you probably got a lot that you can learn from, and you can work your way back up. And that's what sucks for Rivera. Most of the guys who do lose to Munhoz, they are on their way up trying to get their opportunity. And Rivera's been in the top 15 for a long time. He has fought the big names, and he's never been able to get over that hump and really be considered elite himself. And that's what sucks for Rivera. He's one of those, oh, you're kind of perfect for Bellator guys. And I know I kind of say this anytime a guy seems to win a lot by decision and loses in the UFC, but it's true. Jimmy Rivera is perfect for Bellator, and I'd watch him fight pretty much every top bantamweight over there.
Yeah, he's weird because he does have a style. Like I said, he does get his Arturo Gatti Mickey Ward on every once in a while and just plant those feet and swing for the bleachers. But I do think that, you know, he moves his head well, and he kind of goes in with his punches while he's moving his head. So I could see him as a stance switcher. Which would have served him fantastic last night. I just don't see him like completely committed to it. Like, I see where, like, when I look at him, I'm like, oh, he could do it. But I feel like he just sits down on his punches too much. And I agree with you completely about Munhoz. When I look at him, I don't see a champion. You know, sometimes you look at a guy and you're like, yeah, you can see it on him. I don't see, you know, sir, little things, man. You know, when you saw Israel Adesanya, you're like, all right, cool name, cool tats, cool nickname. Like, everything just made sense, right, for Adesanya. You're like, he's going to be – I mean, and listen, some of us were wrong. I thought that about Uriah Hall. So, but –
it's my Zion Williamson theory. If you have a name as great as Zion Williamson, you can't just work at Costco.
Exactly.
Like, you're kind of destined to do something great and be in front of a lot of people. Exactly.
There you go. So, yeah, I mean, we'll see. We'll see where Munhoz moves forward. But I like the Brunson comparison. I think that that's probably going to be his future. All right.
I like watching him fight, though. Like, Pedro Munhoz, I would pay to watch him fight alone. He could just shadow box in a room, and I'd probably get enjoyment out of it. Like, Pedro Munhoz only comes to fight. He doesn't give a crap about CTE.
You know, he's one of these guys, and I guess we can continue the conversation on him a little bit longer, where it's like, and I'm just pulling names off the top of my head. You probably have better ones. But, like, you know, these guys were at their level. They have a lot of diversity. Like, when I watched that Gavin Tucker fight, I was like, man, this guy's bringing lots to the table. When you watch Beneil Dariush fight, at their level, they do a lot of good shit. The question is, can they do that at a higher level?
Exactly.
And I think that's where Munhoz runs into trouble. He isn't quite – it's one of those things where he's not quite as dynamic. You know, it's kind of what, because we're using a lot of basketball analogies on this one. It's kind of what people thought Trae Young was going to be. He ended up being better than they thought he was going to be, but they were going to be like, yeah, you can be like Steph in college. But when you get to the pros, there's no way you're going to pull this off. Well, he's not Steph, but he's doing better than you thought he would have done, right? Listen, you thought that he had a level.
You're talking to one of the biggest Trae Young haters in North America.
But,
okay?
But he's better than you thought he was going to be, though, right?
Listen, Trae Young's not a guy who I want on my team, but I do agree. No, you're right.
But he's not a bust, right? So I thought he was going to be a bust in the pros. I was like, there's no way. There's one Steph. He's mimicking Steph in college. He can't do it in the pros, and he's done it a little bit better than I thought he was going to be. Maybe LaMelo Ball would have been a better example for someone who, like, you're like, eh, that ain't going to work in the pros. And then he got to the pros and it worked. Some guys, they just can't exceed whatever their level is. All right, let's move on to the first fight of the main card, which was Alex Caceres and Kevin Kroom. Matt, when the UFC booked Caceres and Kroom, it was unclear who the fight was meant to showcase. But once the fight started, it was very clear who was going to be showcased on the night. The story of the fight for me was Caceres' takedown defense and slick counters. But listen, both these guys are mid-30s. They both have 12 losses. What'd you see in this fight, and where the hell do we go from here with these two?
It was one of those great examples of here's the thing. Alex Caceres' takedown defense has gotten a lot better as his career's progressed, and you can't take that away from him. He has improved, and I do think he was one of those Uriah Hall types where he was so hyped up. He had the Bruce Leroy. He had that sort of, not that he had the it factor to the Uriah Hall or the Adesanya, but there was definitely something unique about Caceres at one point. He has a fun style. He's a weird case, though, because he's the most dangerous striker who will never knock you out. Like, he can throw a 720 head kick, and you're like, wow, that was really impressive. But he catches guys with it, and they never really fall down. Like, Alex Caceres, dangerous striker, but not a knockout artist by any means. And Kevin Kroom almost turned him into a knockout artist because he just walked forward with his hands down so much. And I get when you are that wrestler who you're so dedicated to the wrestling game plan, your striking might not be up to the level of a lot of the other guys in, you know, at the UFC. But you need cardio if you are going to be really dedicated to that wrestling game plan. Kevin Kroom didn't show anything in terms of cardio in that fight. And I know what happens when you go for the takedown. It takes a lot more energy not getting the takedown than the guy defending it, especially Caceres had the cage. And the other thing Caceres is doing a great job at, he wasn't just moving straight back defending the takedowns. He was doing a great job of getting his back off of the cage. He was never just letting Kroom push, 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 getting up against the cage and then getting taken down. He would get pushed back and then try to always exit on an angle, which is a really great sign when you're looking, and I say you're looking forward to a guy. I understand he's quite old to have the prospect moniker. He's kind of in that Eric Silva category right now, but it was a good win for Alex Caceres. He's on a 4-fight win streak. It's only the second time in his career he's ever been on one of those, and I know he's calling for a ranked fighter. I don't think Alex Caceres is beating a lot of ranked featherweights. It sucks. And at one point, maybe I thought he would have. He fought to a split decision with Yair Rodriguez. And I know Yair is out there hiding from USADA or just not telling them where he is. But I don't want to see Alex Caceres fight Yair Rodriguez. I don't want to see Alex Caceres fight, like, Shane Burgos is barely ranked. There's a good example. Shane Burgos is barely, he might not even be ranked right now at featherweight. Do you know what Shane Burgos would do to Alex Caceres? He would walk through all that spinning shit and just box his ears in, and it wouldn't be that competitive of a fight. So for Caceres, I'm always going to get excited when he fights, but he is at that, like, gatekeeper category where Caceres is only fighting guys who are 2-3 fights into their UFC careers at this point, and that's fine. He is a good gatekeeper in that respect, but I don't think he's getting a ranked fighter anytime soon.
You know, everybody has their position, and Caceres is a Phoenix guy, and Kroom, so they're both good coaches, good gyms, right? Caceres is the lab, and Kroom's with James Krause. So, but here's what I think these guys are kind of destined to be. They're a guy who's really good at getting his teammates prepared for people, and he's a good guy to have in the gym. He's going to win his fights. You know, when I look at Caceres, and this is no disrespect to him, listen, I would make the same argument about, you know, we talked earlier about, because you didn't like the Yuri Prochka fight with Ankalaev. I said, listen, if you don't put on a good fight, I'm going to put you in there with a guy that's going to look to take you out. So I wouldn't hate if Ankalaev had to fight Prochka to say, listen, man, this guy's coming here to take you out. Are you going to fight like you did in this last one? So for me, if you think that Burgos would take out Caceres, I don't know that Caceres, how do I put this? He was pretty impressive in this fight. So if he ever deserves a Burgos fight, it's kind of now. But he's another guy where we talk about at his level, he can do a lot of things. I mean, listen, his takedown defense was very diverse tonight. It was, I'm getting my underhooks. You know, I'm like getting under you to get you to stand you up. I am shooting submissions to get you off your takedown. I'm scrambling. Like, he has a lot of different things, man. There's a lot of nuances to who this kid is, which is why I say he's a great training partner to have. He's going to show you a lot. Like, if you're Casey Kenney and you're getting ready for Dominick Cruz, it's nice to have Alex Caceres in the gym with you. It doesn't hurt to have him around. So, you know, all that movement, all that pace, that's a great thing to have. So, again, I wasn't overly impressed. I was impressed with Caceres. But, again, in what Kroom gave him, that sort of took a little bit away from it. If you're going to walk after him and just be so adamant about trying to get this takedown that you're just not getting, I guess the question becomes, when do you abandon the game plan? Because Kroom was showing no signs of abandoning it. But you know, but in fairness, that's the game plan, right? Like, if he was going to beat him, that's how he was going to beat him.
Plan B's were invented for a reason, and you go to plan C after. I get it, but I do agree with you. Like, when do you switch the game plan? And it would be interesting to actually, like, sit down and talk to a coach and be like, okay, if everything is going bad, and I mean you're only sticking to plan A and you can't get anything going off, what is the game plan? Like, when do you decide, okay, is it after the first round when you do get a minute with your fighter? Does he have some kind of cues going into the fight where, okay, we are going to switch things up? Like, I would be curious to kind of get a feel from different gyms to see what they would say, because I'm sure everyone has a different philosophy to that.
Well, and here's the thing. Unless you talk in hypotheticals with that coach, you're probably not going to get the answer anyway, because here's the answer. If you talk to James Krause, here's what he probably won't tell you that might be the answer, which is, if we stand with Caceres, it's a worse night. Like, if we stop trying to take him down, the night might be worse. So if you're Krause, on the one hand, you want to tell your fighter, okay, maybe it's time to do something else. But you're also thinking to yourself, that something else might have your ass looking at the lights. So, and I mean, listen, I'm with you when you say that, you know, Caceres might not knock him out. I mean, he got some good shots in there and didn't knock him out. But again, now he's getting pieced up and he's looking even worse. So, you know, sometimes it looks better, I'm sure, to the matchmakers that you just had a bunch of failed takedowns than that you got pieced up all night. So, I don't know. Well, it's one of those things where I don't think you'd ever get the honest answer from a coach to that question unless he was speaking hypotheticals. All right, let's move on to the prelim card. Thiago Moises defeated Alex Hernandez via unanimous decision. A couple 30-27s and a 29-28. Before you get into it, we touched on it earlier. Listen, this kid, Matt, went from fighting Cowboy Cerrone and talking shit to him, mind you, fighting Cowboy Cerrone to the cover of Who Gives a Shit magazine. What happened to this kid?
I'm so glad you said that, because there's no one who's going to take more enjoyment out of this than your boy over here. Hey, Alex, what are we doing? Okay, you were one of the most hyped up prospects in the UFC, and I don't think that's an exaggeration at all. I think after he beat Beneil Dariush, because everyone says, oh, Dariush is this dark horse. This is like the third version of Benny and the Jets that we've had in the UFC. You gotta remember, he was ranked before UFC 200. He knocks out James Vick at UFC 199. He had that great win over Michael Johnson, albeit controversial, but still, he's had big fights and he's been ranked before. You knocked out Beneil Dariush in under a minute, and I was extremely impressed. I was like, wow, Alexander Hernandez is going places. And Craig and I talk about this a lot, where on your way up, there's just names that are nice to have on your resume. Like, I love Tim Means, and if a prospect beats Tim Means, I put them in a new category. Like, okay, you passed the Tim Means check. Like, you can beat a guy who I know is extremely technically skilled, who isn't just going to go away with your one clean shot. He's got a good chin, even to this day, and he's just going to get a hard fight out of you, no matter what stage of your career that you're at. Olivier Aubin-Mercier is another one of those guys, and maybe he never reached the heights of a Tim Means, and it's not like Tim Means was ever one of these super talked about fighters, but the Dirty Bird had a few decent runs here and there. OAM's just a hard fighter to beat. He's got good cardio, he's a good wrestler, he's kind of well-rounded everywhere, and I understand his UFC tenure is no longer, I guess he's in the PFL now, but you went out there and you out-grappled him. You beat OAM at his game plan. So you had a flash knockout, which is impressive, but I didn't learn a lot about you. And then you beat a fairly well-rounded fighter by being well-rounded. So I thought very highly of Alexander Hernandez going into that fight. And you talk so much crap to Cowboy Cerrone. Now, I don't know Cowboy, never met him. I'm going to call him Donald, because it's weird to call a man by his nickname, if I'm being honest. I would probably treat Donald Cerrone with quite a bit of respect if I met him in person. Not a cage fighter, never will be, but I think I'd be very nice to the man. And you went out there and you talked all this crap and you wanted to make sure that you were the headliner. And even though Henry Cejudo was fighting TJ Dillashaw, you were going to be the guy that people were talking about at the end of the night. You were, but it's only because you got head kicked about seven times and old man Cowboy put an absolute dad beat down on you. Then you got a gift of a decision in your home state against Francisco Trinaldo. Let's call it what it was. Masaranduba, Francisco won that fight. It was not close. He won every single round, but it was in San Antonio. Where's Alexander Hernandez from? San Antonio. That's weird. And then he loses to Drew Dober. Listen, Drew Dober is one of the better lightweights in the UFC. I think very highly of him. So you've lost to these upper echelon guys, and you've barely beat Francisco Trinaldo on the way out. He's like 43. He'd call me kid, which Crank does to fighters, and he has to stop. But anyways, you beat Chris Grootsmacher, who has a knockout loss to Artem Lobov. And now you lose to Thiago Moises. Hey, Alex, you're not getting a call from Dana White. You're definitely not getting a call from like Bang Energy, like Colby Covington. You got to figure it out. And complaining on Instagram is not the way to do it. And at this stage of your career, listen, you're what? You're 3-2, or sorry, you're 2-3 in your last five, and you should be 1-4 for being honest. Your only real win in the last, let's see here, only real win in basically the last 3 years is a guy who lost to Artem Lobov and Chris Grootsmacher. And hey, Chris, if you're out there watching, I'm sorry, but it's not like beating Grootsmacher is proving to me, wow, you're ready for the top 15 of the UFC. And it feels like every time Alexander Hernandez's name is brought up into the conversation, it's, oh, he should be fighting these guys near the top 15 or in the rankings, where I got to be honest, I don't see who Hernandez beats comfortably, who I can name off the top of my head. And I don't mean that to be disrespectful in any way. I just mean, unless we are talking about fighters who are those kind of veterans near the end of their career on the way out, or those UFC newcomers, I don't know who I can comfortably say Alexander Hernandez beats. Like, if he got matched up with Jim Miller, I think he would beat Jim Miller, but I thought he would beat Thiago Moises, and I thought he would beat most of the guys he's fought in the UFC. Like, I don't know if I'm way too down on Alexander Hernandez. Maybe you can pump me back up and boost my spirits on the Great Whites hype train, but it's just not there. Quit complaining on Instagram, too. It's not a great look.
My favorite part about that rant was that you shit on a guy for 5 minutes and then said, I don't want to be disrespectful by saying I can't think of a guy you'd beat. Now you don't want to be disrespectful. Now's the time that you – no, I can't help you with pumping this kid up, nor will I try. I will say this about the whole Instagram thing. Please tell me the time that ever worked, and I'll be happy to cut you some slack. I mean, we used to do this – you know, a long time ago, I did a recap show with, can't remember the guy's name. It was not for nothing. Not for nothing, man. Instagram doesn't overturn decisions. You know, you got 230-27s, and I'm not saying the judges are the sharpest guys out there, but typically they're not that far off. So
Saul D'Amato and the boys aren't looking at your Instagram story. I'm sorry, no, Alex. I hate to be the guy to break it to you.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, he definitely has talent. It's all the other stuff that kind of gets in the way. He needs to maybe get some focus back. All right. Moving on, Alexis Davis defeated Sabina Mazo via unanimous decision. A couple 30-27s, 30-26. What'd you have here?
Y'all must have forgot Alexis Davis edition. I mean, good job. Like, Alexis Davis is in this weird category because at 135, she looks to be decent. Like, she can beat a lot of these prospects at 135 pounds. And I hate to use the term prospect to describe Cindy Dandois, but I guess I'm being forced to right now. She's beating a lot of sort of these, you know, one or two fights in the UFC kind of fighters. But I do think Alexis Davis is a good example of, she's going to beat UFC fighters who aren't up until 2014 in their progress. And then once they're past that level, she's going to lose to them. Like, Alexis Davis does not fight any differently than she did when she was fighting Ronda Rousey. And that tells you how long Alexis Davis has been around in the sport for. Like, her style is still the exact same. Then look at, she has a win. Okay, here's a great example. Alexis Davis is a TKO win over Amanda Nunes. She fights the exact same way she did back when she fought Amanda Nunes. Do you know how different Amanda Nunes looks between every single fight, much less between all the way back then to now? Like, you see how women's MMA has been able to evolve these last 3, 4, 5 years, and just the explosion that's really been able to take. Alexis Davis, she is that pioneer. She's going to give you a hard fight if you're a prospect, and she's going to teach you those hard lessons that I think every prospect does kind of need to learn on their way up. But I've said this about that fight. Sabina Mazo is going to beat Alexis Davis, but best case scenario is she loses. Because losing to Alexis Davis, there's no real shame in that if you're a prospect on your way up. You lost to a gritty veteran who a lot of people know. But if you beat Alexis Davis, the UFC's not doing you any favors from that point on. You're only fighting tough fights at either 135 or 125 pounds. So losing to Davis for Sabina, I don't think that was the worst case scenario for a UFC career. I think you take a lot of positives from this. Listen, you got taken down by the bigger, stronger fighter. Mazo normally fights at 125 anyways. She still looked okay on the feet for what she could get off there. Like, I don't think this fight taught us much about either fighter. I just think Mazo's proper weight class is 125 pounds. And Alexis Davis is still scrappy.
Matt, I hope you're sitting down as we move on, because there was a finish on this card. Ronnie Lawrence defeated Vince Cachero via TKO round three. Barely got that finish in. What'd you have in this one?
Ronnie Lawrence looked good, didn't he? A lot of people thought that this fight was close, and I did too, but I picked Ronnie Lawrence. Craig picked Vince Cachero at the start of the week. And then I see a lot of, I'll say our peers, our colleagues on Twitter, the Michael Fidels of the world, being like, wow, Ronnie Lawrence, like, I think he has a top 15 ceiling. And I got really excited after that, because I was like, great, Craig's not going to switch his pick, and I'm going to be even one more ahead of him. Craig did switch his pick, and it was a smart move, because that fight was not competitive for its entirety. Like, Ronnie Lawrence, the wrestling, the striking, the way he was able to put everything together, I said this going into that fight. I think Vince Cachero and Ronnie Lawrence are going to have a good fight, but I think both guys are two or three fights away from being UFC quality fighters. I thought they still both needed quite a bit of room to improve before they were ready for the big show. But going forward, like, I think Ronnie Lawrence is UFC ready. I think he showed a lot in that fight, and I understand it matters who he fought. And it's not that Vince Cachero is going to be blowing the doors off the world anytime soon, but it was just a really impressive win where he did involve all facets of MMA. And it's like you would sit up at the main event. It's almost a good thing Gon won by decision, because we learn a lot more about a guy if he goes 25 minutes than if he does just knock out Rozenstruik in 30 seconds. Ronnie Lawrence dominated every minute of that fight, so I was really impressed by him.
Those are kind of the best ones where you dominate the fight and then still get the finish, because you get exactly. All the flowers for the finish, but you also, you know, win a minute. All right, so the night began and we end with Dustin Jacoby defeating Maxim Grishin via unanimous decision. 29-28, it's all over the board. What'd you have here?
I got to be honest, I thought Grishin won that fight, and I picked Dustin Jacoby. He dropped Jacoby twice. It was a weird fight, and Grishin's not the version that we used to get of him. I don't know if it's father time. I don't really know what it is. I don't even know if he's getting another chance in the UFC, to be honest, but he's a PFL guy, and I got to be honest, I'm not the biggest PFL watcher. I will watch some of the cards when, you know, there's the bigger names on there. I'm sure I'll watch Anthony Pettis compete this year, but Craig was a lot more involved watching PFL than I was, and he was very high on Maxim Grishin coming into the UFC, and I think he realized that, yes, Grishin is 36. He is kind of near the end of whatever run you want to say that he's on, but listen, at 205 and really at heavyweight, you can extend your career quite a ways. You can fight into your early 40s and still have success, but you look at the Marcin Tybura fight. At heavyweight, Marcin Tybura is just a tough fight for anyone. It's hard to look good against Tybura, but Tybura beat the absolute piss out of Maxim Grishin. The fight was not competitive. He beat Antigulov, but Antigulov is exhausted 3 seconds into every single fight he's ever been in, and he just gets TKO'd in that classic Antigulov, I'm going to get tired, you're going to TKO me. And then he lost this fight. So I still don't really know what I'm getting from Grishin between every single fight. I think he's hesitant, which is odd, because as a striker, he's not that bad, but I don't know. It wasn't an overly impressive performance by either guy. I thought Grishin deserved to get the win, but it wasn't the most memorable fight where I'm going to be calling the commission members next week trying to get it overturned.
Well, you weren't alone. Dominic Derniot, Marcel Dorf, Jay Petrie, Ben Duffy, Tristan Crutchfield, all on MMA Decisions agreed with you. They had a 28-29 for Grishin. So those guys certainly know what the hell they're talking about. You got a couple of allies there. All right, let's talk about let's hit the wrap. We'll start with some housekeeping. There was three performance bonuses given out. Munoz and Rivera both got 50,000 for fight of the night. Ronnie Lawrence got 50 G's. Bebe for performance of the night for his lone finish of the night. Any arguments here? I mean, it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, there was one finish and one fight deserved to be fight of the night. That, like, there was no other finish, so you can't really say, oh, give it another performance bonus. And there definitely wasn't two fight of the night worthy fights, because I know sometimes they'll do that if there aren't a lot of finishes and there are two, like, phenomenal fights they can't pick between. Sometimes they will do double fight of the night. They did it for Gaslam Adesanya Poirier Holloway, and I understand, like, that was, like, one of the greatest fights of all time in the co-main event, followed by another one of the greatest fights ever in the main event, but they will do that every now and then. But yeah, there was really no argument for a second fight of the night. I thought Munoz and Rivera, one of the better fights we've had up until this point this year, I'd argue. Like, I thought it was that good. And yeah, Ronnie Lawrence only finished, looked good, but Yeah, I don't think Montana De La Rosa deserved one, so I don't know who else I'd give it to.
No, and next week we're loaded for the pay-per-view next week. So they're like, let's put this $50,000 back in the bank and see if we might end up spending it next week. Let's talk about the victory lap. Where were you right this week?
Not often. I got to be honest. It was a tough one. I did better than Craig. That's really all I care about. Let's see. I thought Jimmy Rivera would beat Pedro Munhoz. I did see that fight being close because, again, you know how good both guys are. When you are dealing with the, you know, sort of borderline elite of any division, the fights can be close. But I thought Rivera would be able to out-volume Munhoz a lot more. And because he had used the leg kick in the past, I thought he'd be able to check them or at least use his movement to get out of the way. And it's weird. We talk with Jimmy Rivera. He loves to play on his feet. Hates getting knockouts, though, because of his 23 wins, I'm pretty sure only two or three of them are by stoppage. He's not going out there getting a lot of finishes, which is odd because when he lands, he seems to have quite a bit of impact behind his shots. Just, it's a weird point that I always feel like needs to be brought up about Jimmy Rivera. One of the most heavy-handed pillow-fisted fighters you will ever see in your life. Still a great fight, though, nonetheless. Not much to go off from this card. Listen, it wasn't the best card in the world. Great win for Moises. Good win for Caceres. But no wins that are really going to be like, wow, these are going to resonate with me moving forward.
Yeah, and we talked about the takeaways from tonight. For me, it was, you know, Gon. He went five rounds. He was dominant. He's going to need more if he wants to mess around with that top five of the division. But you know, some of the people that I think maybe have big hopes and dreams for themselves, like you talked about Hernandez, we talked about De La Rosa. Munhoz and Rivera, I kind of like where they're at. I mean, I could see them higher up in the division ranked-wise and having that fight the third time with a lot more stakes. I don't know if I said this earlier, but I'll say it now. I think that's a fight that if you're the UFC, you put that thing in your pocket and you just keep these guys away from each other, let Petr Yan clear out that division, and then you let these guys hook it up for the third time with a title shot on the line. Co-main event or a main event of a fight night. I think you just hold on, know that you have that trilogy between those two guys in your back pocket when you need it. When you need a main event fight night, they're on a one or two fight winning streak, maybe one lost, or you know, I think that's a fight that you always know you have. All right, who do you think won the night?
I didn't. I know. I don't think you felt like you probably didn't win the night after it was done. Like, listen, the UFC didn't really win the night. Canelo Alvarez won the night because he fought me for like $5 million. So he made a bunch of money to fight some guy. I think Thiago Moises probably is your biggest fight of the night. And I know that's weird, but Hernandez, there's always going to be eyes on his fights for better or for worse. Listen, you either pay to see me win or you pay to see me lose. Floyd Mayweather said it. I know a lot of other people said it, but he's the first guy who comes to mind. And it's kind of the case with Hernandez. You're either going to watch him because you want to see him get knocked out, or you're going to watch him because you do like his confidence and his cockiness, and you do think he's got a real ceiling. And Moises, it's not like he took all of his hype or anything. He just got a good win over someone who is recognizable. I think Alexis Davis has a good win, but these aren't wins that are going to get people talking. These are just good wins for that person's career. Like, Alexis Davis on a three-fight losing streak, it was probably it for her if she wasn't able to beat Mazzo. She beats an up-and-coming contender. Like, that's just a good win for your career. And there weren't a lot of life-changing wins, like I had said, but there was just decent wins career-wise. Same thing for Gon. I don't think that main event win is going to change Ciryl Gon's life at all. I think he can still go to the grocery store and not get mobbed by fans. I just think slightly more people know who he is, and his next fight's probably going to be against a top six guy. That's pretty much it. And if that's the biggest winner from the night, I don't think really anyone won.
Yeah, I think now he knows he can go championship rounds. I don't know if he knows he can win them yet because he hasn't fought championship fighters. So, but he knows he can at least go. He can last. He can pace himself out. And but again, we go back to what you said earlier, the Teddy Atlas thing. He's not yet faced adversity. So we really don't know what we have in him. But, you know, if you got Rozenstruik in this one and you won, you're going to get a real test next time out. So you're going to get some guy that's either, and again, in fairness to the kid, he's fought Junior Dos Santos and now he's fought Jairzinho Rozenstruik. So he's passed the tests, you know, but he just hasn't been, he's beat the guys that you would expect him to have to beat on his way to a championship. He just hasn't faced the kind of adversity and we can't blame him for that.
There's a 6'8" Russian with a samurai on his back, just waiting to get into the cage of Ciryl Gon.
There we go. Let's make it happen. All right, let's talk about the broadcast team very quickly. I like how Bisping and Felder are kind of, you know, I've called those guys. Bisping and Fitzgerald will always be the brother-in-laws to me, right? They're two sisters, their husbands, and that's the relationship they have. But I like that Felder and Bisping is funny in that He's one of those guys that always jumps on someone misspeaking for humor, yeah. Which does get a little annoying, but I think Felder rolls with it well. Like if Felder missays something or you know, a phrase that has a word in there it doesn't need, Bisping will pounce on it for his own humor. I think Felder handles it well, so it's comfortable. I think the UFC is starting to figure out who they like in what spots. They really like Anik, DC, and Rogan. I think Rogan's probably got a couple of years left. We've been saying that forever, though. Rogan's probably got a couple of years left, and once he's done,
it was a couple months.
Cruz will kind of slide in there.
Interesting, though. Fun fact, you brought this up. Dustin Poirier was on Joe Rogan's the other day, and he said that that's something he'd like to do in the future. So maybe they get him on board.
He'd be damn good at it. So, all right. Let's talk about moving forward. The UFC stays at the Apex. This next one's a big one. They're opening the doors, three title fights. We got Style Bender. We got Polish Power. We got No Mercy. And we got the Lioness all in the building, all pushing gold. It's a big one. So give me your initial thoughts about next week.
I got to be honest. You know what fight I'm the most excited for? It's not the Jan Blachowicz Israel Adesanya fight. I got to be honest. Piotr Jan Aljamain Sterling is going to be insane. Like, that fight's so much fun because no matter where it goes, it's going to be insane. You know what Aljamain Sterling's really good at? Striking and never getting tired. You know what he's even better at? Choking out number one contenders in under 2 minutes, because that's what he did to Corey Sandhagen. And Aljamain Sterling, no one really talks about him when they do talk about that upper echelon of jiu-jitsu and MMA, but I think people are going to have to start to, because he's just got that really fun mix of wrestling and jiu-jitsu. It's not too hot. It's not too cold one way or the other. He's not like Sarah McMahon where he doesn't know what he's good at. I'm calling you out, Sarah. But Aljamain Sterling is just good no matter where the fight goes. Piotr Jan has two modes. He has the I'm going to download what you're doing mode, where he just stays really sound defensively. And then he has KGB mode. And KGB mode is terrifying, because when Piotr Jan moves forward and really lets his hands go, and if he has you up against the cage, he never stops throwing punches. He goes to the body. He goes to the head. He's an amazing counter wrestler. Like, I think Piotr Jan is going to clear out this division. I'll be completely honest. I think he's going to go down as a historic great in the UFC. I really do. And maybe that's just high hopes from my part. Maybe I just like what I've seen from the Aldo fight and the Faber fight. And you can come back at me and say, listen, his two best wins are against older fighters. You're right. I can't argue against it. But what I can say is the way he was able to dominate those two guys was insanely impressive. And he doesn't just beat you by TKO. Like, he makes you quit. And I know that's an overused term in MMA, but like, Piotr Jan legit makes people quit. He gets you in a crucifix on the ground. Like, he's got that kind of ugliness about his fighting style that a lot of fighters don't have. And he's sort of the polar opposite of Charles Oliveira. I don't know why Oliveira is my example for this, but when I think of like beautiful MMA, what Charles Oliveira does is very aesthetically pleasing. Like, he floats on top with his jiu-jitsu. He's just got this very fun style about him. Piotr Jan, there's nothing fun about it. He just walks forward with that high style. He's going to walk you down. He's going to dominate you. I'm so excited for that fight. I really can't put it into words. Like, I think that fight's going to steal the whole night.
Yep. Jan is this weird guy. He's got Triple G vibes to me. He reminds me a lot of Gennady Golovkin in the sense that he could go on one of these runs where no one can get near him. I will say this, okay? And there's a larger, you know, you talked about my John Jones story earlier. There's a much larger podcast to do. I don't know if it's necessarily this podcast, but about what I'm about to say and why I'm about to say it. But I will say this. UFC has a very odd relationship with their black fighters. And so this is what I mean when I say that. This may be Aljamain Sterling's shot. And I think that he is aware of that. And I think that if this is, and listen, he comes from a lineage of guys that go in and get things done against people you don't think they're going to get things done against, right?
How Matt dare Sarah you bring GSP. Up that Canadian connection?
Matt Serra beat GSP. Chris Weidman beat Anderson Silva. Ally Aquinta went the distance with Khabib. Didn't beat him, but, I mean, there's a lineage there. So, I mean, if you factor in that this is real, I mean, he's been begging for this title shot forever. And to his credit, I read an article a long time ago, he refused to use Matt Serra's relationship with Dana White to get to his advantage, right? To his credit. But this might be the shot. And sometimes when that's all you got, you can really, you know, Petr Jan, if he loses this fight, you know, he's got options. Aljamain Sterling may not have the same options. And I think that if he understands the stakes this weekend, we might get a really good, I mean, he's a guy with a lot of talent. And he could bring a lot of things that Petr Jan's not used to seeing to the cage. Now, Petr Yan can bring a lot of things he's not used to seeing as well. So I'm with you. That might be the fight to watch. That might be, you know, one of those things where you go, okay, who's gonna be the surprise of the night, right? If obviously Nunes is probably gonna win and Stylebender is probably gonna win, but that could be the one of the three where someone's walking out of there with a new belt. Obviously, Stylebender would have a new belt if he won. So I'm excited. I can't wait to do the recap next week. As always, this has been the FMP Recap Show. I'm John Franklin. That's Matt Allen. There you have it. One more in the win column. One more for the highlight reel. One more for Fight Night Picks. Peace.